On this episode of This Week in Space, Tarek and I explore the world of the very best and very worst space movies of all time. Also, Russia will stay with the ISS, OSIRIS-REx continues its mission, and Starliner is back at bat. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 10, recorded on May 6, 2022, the best and worst space movies of all time. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Blue Land. Sometimes, in order to go green, you've got to get blue. Blue Land, that is. Blue Land was founded on the belief that a cleaner planet starts by reducing waste while creating powerful, effective cleaners for your entire home. And you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has everything you need to level up your IT skills while you enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30 at checkout. Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of This Week in Space, the best and worst space movies edition. This is the one you've been waiting for, or maybe not. I'm Rod Pyle, your overly effervescent host, and I'm joined by Space.com's Tarek Malik, who I believe thinks Scooby-Doo is high art. How are you doing today, Tarek?
Hello. Doing well. Ready to beam in. Talk about some
space. Were you a Space Jam fan?
I enjoyed Space Jam. I also enjoyed Space Jam 2, which we watched as a family just recently. So.
Oh. Sequelized.
But that was okay, cyberspace. Well, does it really count? I don't know.
You may be surprised to hear that I have a space movie joke today.
Oh, no. I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready. Hit me.
So, Star Wars, where did Luke get his cybernetic hand?
I'm not sure, Rod. Where did he get that hand?
From the secondhand store, of course. Okay, let's try another one. How does Darth Vader like his toast?
How? Dark?
On the dark side. Okay, we got crickets for that one. That's fair enough. Okie dokie, onward. So it's that time. We're going to talk about the best and worst space movies of all time. This is a pretty subjective list, though it is based on many, many minutes of intensive research, at least, some emails from you folks, and a whole lot of opinion, and partially from my questionable career in science fiction television. I'll also note that we're looking mostly at movies that have some basis in science fact to space exploration. So, while you got to give a nod to a movie like Star Wars and so forth, we're trying to keep it around something that at least saw hardware going into space and not just complete fantasy or space opera. So, hopefully you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll want to run us out of town, but in your heart, you're going to know we're right. Isn't that right?
That's right. There are some ringers, I think. There's some personal ones that may not be truly, truly authentic space, but are in that vein of those franchises that I've got that are close to my heart, I think. So.
Yeah, well, I know one loser film that you're going to talk about in particular, but we'll wait till we get there. Got 4% on Rotten Tomatoes. Okay. And we'll also look at some films you've probably never heard of, unless you're a silent movie fan. But first, some headlines. So, Tarek, OSIRIS-REx rides again. Second life for a number of programs, including our favorite asteroid sampler.
That's right. NASA has extended 8 of their, I think it's like 14 active interplanetary missions. And one of the big standouts is OSIRIS-REx, which you and our listeners may know is the big asteroid sampling mission that NASA launched a few years ago to the asteroid Bennu, and it's going to be coming back with some pieces of that asteroid next year, actually. And NASA has extended it, so instead of it being called OSIRIS-REx, it's now going to be called OSIRIS-APEX, and it's going to go to the asteroid Apophis, which is that kind of infamous asteroid that we hear every year is going to hit Earth in 2032 or 2036 or 2029 or who knows when. But NASA has really ruled out the danger for like the next 100 years or so. So, but still, it's a big asteroid. It's a near Earth asteroid and it's a good example of a hazardous one. And so they're going to name it the OSIRIS Apophis Explorer after the Bennu samples come back to Earth, and it's going to go and head off there and do a nice little rendezvous. So that's pretty exciting, and it's not alone. in addition to OSIRIS-REx, the Curiosity rover, which has been on Mars since 2012, I got a life extension. It's doing just fine. And Gusev crater, is that where it is? Man, I got a... No, it's in Gale crater. That's right.
And then
the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which was supposed to be the first vanguard of all of NASA's missions to go to the moon for Constellation. We were going to get like sample returns and rovers, and all we got was this orbiter. That mission is still going strong. It's shown us astronaut footprints on the moon and all that wonderful stuff, and it's still doing well. So they're going to use it for Artemis and keep on trucking. MAVEN at Mars, that's an atmospheric mission to study where the water went in that planet. Having some problems, some hardware problems, just because it's pretty old. It's been there since about 2014. It launched in 2013. And the InSight Mars Lander, which despite everything still is listening to Mars quakes on the red planet.
But not measuring heat flow.
Not measuring, no. It had that heat probe that got stuck, and they just could not get it into the ground. The Martian terrain turned out to be a bit too rocky and tough for them to get this hammer, at least the way that they built it. It was a little thing that was going to hammer itself all the way down into the ground. New Horizons, which flew by Pluto, has been extended, which is exciting. It's going to go out into the Kuiper Belt or further out and explore those icy objects on the fringe of our solar system. And Mars Odyssey, which is one of the oldest orbiters at Mars. It's been there since 2001. So basically my entire space.com career, it's been there. And it's still going strong. And so that and the powerful Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter round out the extension crew. The MRO launched in 2005, and it's been, if you ever see those really, really high res images of Mars, it's most likely they came from that orbiter, and it's just an amazing, just prolific mission. We used to measure its output in DVDs, Rod, when those were really important, you know.
Yeah. Was that when the planetary data system was still publishing that stuff?
Yeah, trying to explain what a petabyte was, and I think it's way beyond that now. So,
yeah, I wasn't surprised to see the Mars orbiters continued because if nothing else, they're needed to relay home all the bunches of data that come from the rovers. So that's good that they're keeping those going. All right, so just yesterday or the day before, a little bit of a surprise. We've been hearing the back and forth about Russia and NASA and the future of the ISS, at least in terms of our partnership with Russia. It's up, it's down, it's all around. Then Bill Nelson comes out, a little surprisingly to me anyway, and says, nope, they're in. They're not going anywhere. Don't worry about it. What's that all about?
Well, this was a really tough one at space.com because me and Mike Wall, my colleague there, had a big discussion about all of this bluster from Dmitry Rogozin. We've talked about Dmitry Rogozin many times before, and he is very staunchly, you know, pro Russia's war in Ukraine, and has been using all of the sanctions against Russia as fodder to say, oh, we're going to pull out of every space mission that we're cooperating with. They've done some of that. They've cut off their rockets to Europe and to others. And he's been saying that they're going to pull out from the space station and build their own space station basically since this war began. And over the weekend, it came out that he said, oh, we've given formal notice that we're going to pull out in a year. And it was a big discussion. Are we going to write about what he's saying? Because he's been saying it over and over again. And the facts of the case are that the Russian engineers that are part of the International Space Station program are still doing their job. They're still working and cooperating. And the cosmonauts and astronauts are working together in space too. And NASA has said over and over again that the partnership is still going. You know, the safety of the astronauts and cosmonauts is primary. Nothing official has been said. Bill Nelson this week, in speaking to Congress, said the exact same thing. He said that they're not pulling out, that all of those headlines that have come out over the last week since Rogozin made his interview with state-run media were misleading, and that the actual partnership, like the boots-on-the-ground partnership, is continuing apace. So I would just advise, if you see a lot of headlines about what Dmitry Rogozin is saying about the partnership, as my colleague Mike Wall wrote today, take it with a grain of salt, because he is saying a lot of things that support kind of the Russian party line about, you know, in retaliation to sanctions against the country and whatnot. And they're not really matching what the astronauts, what the engineers, what the cosmonauts are all seeing on the ground. One thing to keep in mind, though, Rod, is that pretty soon NASA and Russia will have to make a decision about if a Russian cosmonaut will fly on a SpaceX Dragon commissioned by NASA to go to the space station pretty soon. We're waiting on that. We expect to hear in the next few weeks or months. But that's a key decision point to see, like, how robust is this partnership going to go? Or will Russia let them fly on those ships or keep them solely on Soyuz?
Well, you may not have been sure what to write, but I was sure what to put up on Instagram and Facebook, and we did our own little private observance of Rogozin and his antics. But enough about that. So just finally, quickly, because we've talked about it already, but Starliner.
Boeing, yes.
Yes, you listened to the press conference. You know exactly what's going on.
Well,
so just a little background. This is supposed to be the competitor to SpaceX's Crew Dragon. Boeing got a lot more money than SpaceX got to put this together and offer rides to the space station for astronauts, and has been working on it for, 7 years now?
Oh, it's been, at least seven.
So we tried to test flight, had some problems, tried a second test flight and didn't get off the pad. So what's next?
Yeah, we're coming up on a year almost since that second test flight attempt. I know that the listeners can't hear it, but I've got my little foam spongy,
Boeing
Starliner.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Boeing basically got a do-over from NASA to do an uncrewed test flight to the International Space Station with Starliner, because that first flight fell short. It didn't reach the right orbit, couldn't get to the space station, came back way earlier than planned. Then when they tried again, they just like hours before launch, they found out that they had these valves in the propulsion system of the capsule that were stuck, 13 out of 24 of them. That's a lot of valves.
Corroded.
And they couldn't figure it out. So what they did is they pulled the service module off of it and built a brand new one, and they're going to use that for this mission. So finally, after all that work, nearly a year, Boeing and NASA say that they're ready to actually try this do-over flight again. And it's supposed to launch from Florida on an Atlas V rocket on May 19th. And when they do that, this will be like their big test. SpaceX did this years ago. You know, and so they're trying to catch up, and there are astronauts who have been training for the first crewed flight on this vehicle for just as many years. And Sunita Williams is one of them, the veteran astronaut and former space station commander. And so everyone's going to be watching this flight. Have they ticked off all their boxes? Have they finally gotten everything right that they can launch this capsule, spend about 5 days or so at the International Space Station, turn around, come back, make a land-based landing, because it's designed to land on land, and then turn it around and hopefully, if all goes well, get ready for a crewed flight. Maybe early 2023, Boeing may be trying to squeeze that into the end of this year, but everything has to go right for this mission, and so they're going to be really watching it like a hawk. But it is good to be at this point now where they think that if they solve this valve problem and they're ready to go.
Well, and we kind of talked about this a little bit in a previous episode, but the solution to the valve problem fascinated me. So apparently the issue was the metal of the valve, where the valve bodies were made out of, reacted with the propellant and the moisture, ambient moisture in the atmosphere at the Cape. Now,
yeah.
Cape's on the ocean, so we know there's going to be moisture there. Boeing's been involved with rockets since the beginning of the space age. So how this kind of escaped planning is puzzling, you know, unless it was just a loss of institutional knowledge. I mean, there's a big conversation to be had about what's happened to Boeing over the last 10-ish years, but we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But the final solution for this, and I suppose it was probably more a matter of money and time than anything else, was, well, we'll just put more seals around them so they don't get as damp. So we'll see. I also suspect they'll try to roll the rocket out to the pad as late as possible and launch as early as possible, but there's only so much you can do. All right. Well, there you go. Well, and good luck, and Boeing.
Yeah, be looking for photos. It's being attached to its rocket right now inside its vertical assembly building. So vehicle integration building, pardon me. That's what they call it there at the United Launch Alliance. So things are continuing. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of showstoppers right now. But we'll find out more next week when they have their big briefing.
Keep all eyes on space.com. All right. Well, we're going to be talking about space movies, good and bad, in just a moment. After this message from our Earth-oriented friends at Blue Land. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion, that's 5 billion with a B, plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away every year? And if that's not wasteful enough, each of those bottles can be filled with more than 90% water. That's a lose-lose situation for the planet. Also, plastic has been found in 100% of marine turtles, almost 60% of whales, 36% of seals, and 40% of seabird species examined. By 2050, get this, scientists predict that the ocean will contain more plastic by weight than fish. So we need to start creating a cleaner planet from home. Blue Line's idea is simple, and it's also beautiful. You buy the bottle once, you refill it forever. No more plastic waste. The only thing you need to discard is your outdated idea that eco-friendly products are either more expensive or less effective. Because with Blue Land, they're not. You just fill their beautiful bottles with warm water, pop in one of the hand soap or spray cleaner tablets, and in a few minutes you've got powerful cleaning products in the most incredible scents you can imagine, like iris agave, Perrine lemon, and lavender eucalyptus. I love Blue Land products. I subscribed about 3 or 4 months ago. And at this point, that's all we use because they're not only attractive, but they're incredibly effective. And I like the idea that I'm doing something good for Earth. So from their best-selling Clean Essentials kit to their hand soap duo and plastic-free laundry and dishwasher tablets, Blue Land has something for every inch of your home. Also, backed by popular demand, is Blue Land's toilet tablet cleaner. Get it before it sells out again. Blue Land's stunning, high-quality forever bottles start at just $10 when you buy a kit, and are meant to be reused forever with money-saving refill tablets that start at just $2. Try Blue Land today. You'll love it. I know I did. And the planet will love you. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. That's 20% off your first order of any Blue Land products at blueland.com/space. blueland.com/space. Okay, so Tariq, why don't you kick off with your top 5 or 6 favorite space movies and why?
Okay. All right. So I've got
knock me out.
I got a short list, and it's probably very traditional. And they're most of them are pretty new. Okay. When I think compared to some of the other lists that are out there, but my favorite six, and it was really hard to pick six. But they are Apollo 13, which I think everyone can really agree on, The Martian, right? Well, the Apollo 13, because it was one of those formative movies that came out while I was still in my little chrysalis of becoming a space reporter.
Oh, stop reminding me how young you are.
And I was fascinated. I was fascinated. So, you know, it was directed by Ron Howard. Is that right? Yeah. And you've got the. I think I had just read the Apollo 13 book that it was based on. The one that was originally entitled, you know, Lost Moon, and then
Lost
they renamed
Moon, Jeffrey Kluger's book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
Strong hand of Tom Hanks helping guide the ship, which is great because between him and Ron Howard, they made sure they got it right.
And they filmed in microgravity, which was amazing to me at that time. So that was one. And then The Martian, that which is a lot more recent, because of just how amazing it was, and I love the orange palette for spacesuits and for rovers. I love the fact that I know that there were some liberties taken about how accurate it was, but it was really, really close. All of the things
just
that
a
we've
couple,
seen.
Just a couple. Okay, yes, but pray continue.
And just, I love the, I think that that movie really gave the public an idea of how fun space could be. And aside from some of the other movies that I'm going to talk about right now, The Martian was the first really kind of high fidelity space kind of exploration movie that really tried to be accurate, but also had that joy of exploration, you know. So it's a disaster. He's stuck right on Mars, Mark Watney, but he doesn't regret becoming an astronaut. Whereas I think on your list, we might hear about Gravity and the phrase, "I hate space," is in there. And that's one of the things that one of the issues I had with that. But I really enjoyed that film. And it felt very NASA spirity, you know, the can do attitude in adversity, which I think is schmaltzy, but that's what really tugs me at the end of the day. Interstellar, which I think that you also might have enjoyed. No, maybe not. You're the face. You're making a face, making a big Sorry. Face.
I know it's audio, but yeah, I got some serious problems with Interstellar, but that doesn't mean you have to.
I'll tell you why. I liked Interstellar because of the involvement of Kip Thorne, the super mega mind scientist, about what black holes would look like, how they would affect time, what exoplanets, how they'd be affected near black holes. Now, there is a lot to be said, very similar to Gravity, about people that are starring in a movie and don't like to be in space. I believe they launch a Saturn V-like rocket from a missile silo in the middle of a mountain, which would be a little difficult to do.
In secret. Nobody hears or sees it go. It's a secret, yes.
And you've got a really weird-looking robots, but the mood of it really grabbed me and just the weird ideas that it posited. I had problems with it too, but it's still on my top list there.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Moon. Have you seen Moon, Rod?
Yeah. That's the one, with the astronaut that's kind of stranded in the moon base by himself.
Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
A solo astronaut on a moon base mining helium-3.
Who I wanted to be a little bit more like he was in the Galaxy Quest, but I did think it was a good movie. Yeah, I have to agree with that one.
And spoiler alert, he finds out that he's a clone and that his whole existence is just to be there, being told he can come home. But then as a clone, he breaks down and he discovers it all and hijinks ensue. Another one of those that's really, really close, like what you would expect a moon base to really look like a really well-developed one. I liked the hardware of it. I'm a Sam Rockwell fan. I did like him in Galaxy Quest. We were just talking about that. So that one really kind of got me. But there's an isolation aspect that we hear about a lot from astronauts that I think really comes across in that movie. His only friend is a robot that he has to work with over time, and he has to. Send little boxes to the moon full of helium-3 on what looked like a mag rail, which I thought was really cool. So
send them to Earth, you mean?
Yeah, they send it to Earth. Yeah, I wrote a short story. It was really, really bad, right? But it had these rocket boxes that were just like a giant box that you would fling off on a maglev to the moon. So seeing something like that actually in a movie was really exciting to see.
And you got excited. And by the way, robots in any space movie should kill people. They should go on rampages. And I mean, I grew up with Lost in Space, and in the first episode, the robot actually tried to kill everybody, but I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interfere.
Well, funny to say, because my next two are 2001 and Forbidden Planet, in which we have some fairly ominous robotic or computer entities. So I think 2001 is a very traditional choice, right? You've got your Kubrick film. You've got Pan Am in space. Strange oddity on the moon again that sends everyone off to Jupiter, and the big space baby. And there are a lot of iconic scenes and concepts that really come out of.
Now, how old were you when you saw this first time?
2001, I must have like seen on rebroadcast on television throughout, you know, being a kid, but I did not see it in its glory until I was in college and I took a science fiction fantasy class, you know, really important, hard hitting electives. and we watched it there in its full on like a 70 millimeter screen, and it was just absolutely amazing. And I still, you know, always wonder what actually happened to Dave Bowman as the astronaut, and who he's looking at, and why he sees himself as an old guy there at the end. And
well, what happened to Dave Bowman was he ended up working on Star Lost for a couple of seasons, which may in fact be the very most dreadful television science fiction series ever made. But that, oh, sorry, that's Keir DeLay, not Bowman. Yeah. Yeah. The ending was a little confusing, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's still, you know, it's iconic out there. It has you have an iconic beginning. You've got the Zarathustra. Man, I cannot say
Zarathustra.
The name of that song. There you go.
Zarathustra.
For the music that everyone knows. And in fact, when the train leaves my station in New Jersey, it sounds mm-hmm. exactly like the beginning notes of that song. And I think about it all the time after I get off the train and I'm coming home. And then Forbidden Planet, I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And that one is like the Tempest in space, but you've got an early robot, right? It was Robbie, I think, at that time.
Yep.
And you've got just like it's a really strange way to tell what is essentially the Tempest with amazing sets. And that was probably one of the first classic movies that I realized was a science fiction movie that was different than like Star Wars or Star Trek.
Well, let's note that was 1956 and
yeah, yeah.
special effects by Disney, basically their animation wing. So that was, of course, a huge advance for science fiction at the time. It's huge.
Now, my last one, and this is kind of where we depart a bit, is Star Trek.
Oh, we've departed plenty. But go ahead.
Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which I contend is the best Star Trek movie of all time, even better than Khan, and you cannot change my mind. So, and this is why. This is why. So Star Trek VI came out in 1992, and mm-hmm. At a time, right, where the Cold War was ending, and or had ended, actually. And that's kind of the story that it tells. And to me, that was the epitome of what Star Trek always was, talking about, you know, taking the real situations that we have to deal with, translating them into concepts that the public could actually understand and why they were important. And you see that whole, like the fall of the Soviet Union versus the you know, the United States with the Federation and the Klingon Empire. And then also, I won free tickets to a premiere for that movie, and I could not.
So that's a good reason.
Yeah, and it was a radio contest that I called in on. It was like Star Trek trivia, but I was 15, and you had to be 18 to get your limo ride to Sacramento, because I grew up in Stockton, to see that film. But just I would watch that. I taped it off of cable, and I watched that movie every day for an entire summer after it had come out on cable or VHS.
And you're admitting this, actually.
Oh, it's an awesome...
You're admitting mental health issues on the air.
You should watch it. There's Bridge on the River Kwai vibes to the Ruripente, the prison that they're on, you know, about how there's no stockade and there's no tower, straight out of Bridge on the River Kwai. I mean, it was wonderful, wonderful things that they did with that film. I love it. I love it to this day. It was a good send-off, and no one should have been in any of the follow-up movies that came after that.
And Christopher Plummer looked pretty cool with his eye patch riveted onto his skull. All right.
Metal eye patch. Yeah.
Well, let me go over a couple of those, because there are some matches in our list. Apollo 13, no argument.
Ding.
Incredible film. Wonderfully accurate. Yes, they compressed some action and blended some things and some characters for the sake of a screenplay, but as anybody who spent time around NASA or Mission Control could tell you, you want to compress things, because as intense as that experience was, there's still a lot of downtime, and that's why movies compress action, because you want to keep it engaging and interesting. And I have to just, once again, Tom Hanks and Ron Howard, God bless you guys for keeping it real, because that movie was so, after years of watching mostly bad TV movies when I was younger after the space race. There were some really, remember that you may have been too young, but they used to make TV movies of the week. They always had these burned in yellow titles and god awful jazz scores. So you knew exactly what they were when they came on, you know, the real lives of Mission Control. And it was, you know, the wives and the soap opera moments and all that. They were just awful. And nothing ever happened. And if they had rockets, it was just stock footage. So it was wonderful to see Apollo 13 finally pick up the mantle and do that right. The Martian. Wow. Yeah. I like the moment where he finds Pathfinder.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool. A couple things. I mean, you're right. It made it fun. And it was nice to see a movie where people in space smiled and were actually enjoying some of the moments. Because to create drama, so many filmmakers, like Ad Astra, which is one of the movies I can barely stand to say the words out of my mouth, even though it's the name of my magazine, because it was such a hideous film. Everything about space is miserable, from screaming chimps to him accidentally, quote-unquote, wiping out the crew of the spaceship that he hijacks. So it was nice to see the Martian have some light moments. How? Now they went to Jim Green, who was the chief scientist at NASA at the time, and said, we'd like you to advise us on our film. And he said, sure. So you and I both have seen The Martian. He's seen The Martian. I talked to him about The Martian. I said, Jim, there's some moments there that were a little puzzling to me in terms of your scientific advising. He said, he put his hands up. He said, hey, I told him they decided what to do. So right from the get-go, our rockets on Mars, we're waiting for Watney to come back from whatever it is he's doing. And, oh, my God, we have to take off because the wind's blowing. At 200 miles an hour, and the rocket's going to topple over. Well, the Martian atmosphere is almost non-existent. It's really thin. So you would probably not even hear it or feel it. You know, the rocket might vibrate a little bit. So that was kind of a weak moment. And as Pascal Lee was telling us last week, if you brought the Martian soil into your habitat and tried to grow potatoes in it, you'd soon be lying in the corner with all your mucous membranes puffed out, gasping for air because you're breathing perchlorate-laced dust. And, oh, yes, if there's a big hole in the side of your habitat, you can't just tape plastic sheets over it because there's a near vacuum outside. So, you know, wine, I'm being a ribbit counter. there were some issues there. But it was pretty entertaining. But I have to tell you, and I'm significantly older than you, so this is part of the reason, about halfway through the film, I thought, I've seen this movie before. So I went home after I saw The Martian, dug out my Laserdisc player, dug out my Laserdiscs, found a copy of Robinson Crusoe on Mars from 1964, the first scientifically accurate science fiction movie about Mars, it said on the cover, and put that in. And it's a little wacky because they actually do find aliens, and the aliens have slave ships, and they're all kind of weird stuff, heat rays and so forth. But the setup and the visual effects, it was a George Pal production, were super duper. Oh, and there she is, Mona the Space Monkey, because you got to have a space monkey when you're doing these science fiction. And Adam West was in it briefly. He cashes in when they land on Mars. But it has a lot of really good elements. Nobody's seen it. I don't think anybody under 50 has ever heard of it. But it's worth checking out if you haven't, just to kind of complete the loop. Interstellar. Pluses. Physical effects. It was the first movie to use extensive miniatures in science fiction in decades. So I interviewed the visual effects producer for that film. And the only visual effect that was not at least mostly physical props was the Saturn V at the beginning, interestingly. That mm-hmm. was CGI. Mm-hmm. But
the ships were amazing. I love those ships, yeah.
Yeah, and when you build miniatures, because when I was working on Trek, one of the reasons I left was we were shutting down the miniature shop, and I wasn't interested in CGI at that point. You know, when you see the 8-foot Enterprise model get yanked out of the crate, and you rig it up, and you do all these motion control passes, it's really something. And I would have loved to have been on the set for Interstellar in the effects shop to see those sequences, because they are quite good. Now, on the other hand, you have Matthew McConaughey, who struts around with his preening lantern jaw, chin stuck out in front of him for the whole thing, talking with that kind of weird Texas accent he's got. And I just couldn't buy him, you know?
He says, I want to go to space. All right, all right, all right. Right?
Yeah, it just bugged me. And all I could think of was him sitting in a Lincoln Navigator with his hands slung over the wheel. What a fine car. And it just bugged the hell out of me. I don't know why. Kip Thorne was awesome. You know, he was a colleague of Stephen Hawking and, mm-hmm. and an incredible force in science on his own. The effects for the black hole were wonderful. I did have some issues with the bar fight on the ice with Matt Damon. I wasn't quite sure why we had to see 20 minutes of those guys duking it on the ice when it really had very little to do with the movie. Yeah, I know they're setting up the crazy lonely guy who was stuck there and all that. But really? And those robots? Are robots supposed to look like hardback books with a walking problem? So there was just
don't malign Tars. He's a great guy. Tars is a great robot. So
you need help. No, Curiosity was a great robot. Tars was a very poor design, in my opinion. But so all that, and then we get to the ending and the library scene, his daughter, and then I got to see Matthew McConaughey to force out some glycerin tears, and I'm thinking, oh, please don't. So almost 3 hours to basically say love conquers all.
Yes.
Do we really need 3 hours to say love conquers all, or could we just have said love conquers all and watch another movie?
So call me dead inside, but that is the one that is the one place that film lost me is, yes, I'm there for it. I'm there. And then there's a big speech about how, why can't love be a force? And I'm like, no, you're there to save the humanity. just go do your job as an astronaut, right?
Yes, please.
You know, make your case on why you want to go to one planet versus another. So that was the part that I had a lot of challenges with. And I guess whatever happens at the end when he's in the black hole kind of going for, we didn't even talk about the black hole. Oh my gosh. I completely forgot about the Disney black hole.
No.
Yes. We got to talk about that if we can.
Anyway. I got to get through my last reaction to yours. And then I get to go onto my list. Then you could talk about the black hole if you truly must. 2001: A Space Odyssey. I think I was 10 when I saw it, and there had been this huge media buildup. And I remember clipping a coupon for the back of the LA Times Weekly magazine and giving it to my dad, saying, "If I don't see this movie, I'm going to die. This is the coolest science fiction thing I've ever seen. This is, and I've done all the reading about it. And Stanley Kubrick. I didn't realize that Stanley Kubrick hated human beings, which is why all his movies feel like, you know, liquid nitrogen in terms of their human relationships. But other than that, it looked really cool. So we went and saw it in the Cinerama Dome, which is the way to see that movie in 70 millimeter. And man, that first half, the Pan Am Clipper, the space station, the Orion craft going to the moon, the landing on the moon bus, all that was just incredible. I mean, that was so moving. I was practically in tears because I'm finally seeing the stuff I've been dreaming about all my life. Then part two starts, and we're on our way to Jupiter and the Discovery. Wonderful miniature work. The effects hold up to this day. I mean, you saw it years later in a theater. I saw it probably 10 years ago in a theater. Just magnificent. I mean, those guys, Doug Trumbull and those guys, just knocked it out of the park. Then you get to the ending. And I have to tell you, as a 10-year-old boy watching Keir DeLay eating poached eggs in a robe and then getting up and wondering what that funny noise was and turning around and seeing him decay into a wrinkled prune in his bed in that weird French Renaissance bedroom, and then seemingly hours of a slit scan light show, although I know it was just minutes, but that whole, I guess, landing on Jupiter or going through the dimensional gate or whatever he was doing. And then there's the moon baby orbiting around
Space
Earth.
Space baby.
Thinking of what it should do next. And as a young man who had never and did never take LSD or anything else, I have to say I was ill-prepared for that, and it was confusing. So, you know, A-minus, B-plus for a fantastic movie with a kind of a dinged-up ending that I could have done without. But that's just me. I shouldn't criticize his artistry. Clearly, he was onto something bigger or better, or he just had a short circuit in his brain. Either way, it was an incredible motion picture. So yeah, that's got to be, I think, at the top of anybody's list. If for nothing else, just being the first movie of its kind to really drive its stake in the ground and say, okay, this is what science fiction should look like. Mm-hmm. So I've got a few more to go through, but first we're going to go to a message from some people who do know good media making, IT Pro TV. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by IT Pro TV. It's important when looking for an online IT training platform that you're getting the most up-to-date content and certifications. So let me make it easy for you. Go to IT Pro TV. I did. I watched a number of their sample episodes, and it's good stuff. They're well-produced. They're very informative and they're entertaining. In fact, they've just released a new course, CompTIA A+ Core 1 and Core 2 series. The course is designed for professionals who support today's core technologies, from security to networking to virtualization and more. CompTIA's A+ certification is an industry standard for launching IT careers in today's digital world. In this course, you'll learn about hardware, operating systems, networking, security, and troubleshooting. Now, we talk about how great IT Pro TV is, but here's a reminder of why we say that. They have 7 studios where they film Monday through Friday. Their courses go from the studio to the course library in 24 hours and are divided into 20 to 30 minute episodes for easy binging. They make sure you're prepared for your exams with their virtual labs and practice tests. And they're fun to watch. These guys know how to make TV and they do a really great job. And the best part about IT Pro TV is that you can learn to get certified on your own schedule, and it's always entertaining. May is ramping up for summer, and so is IT Pro TV. Their free Azure weekend is scheduled for May 14th and 15th, so head over to their website to get free courses and a great introduction to your next IT career. IT Pro TV will have 2 free webinars this month for you to check out. What is Azure Bicep with Adam Gordon and Wes Bryan, and that's available on demand. And on May 19th at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, All Things Cybersecurity with Daniel Lowry and John Hammond. And don't forget about your IT team. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan for your team today. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30. That's itpro.tv/twit and use code TWIT30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. All right, now I get to slather you with my list. You didn't mention Destination Moon. It was another George Pal production, one of his first, 1950. You know, it's an old science fiction movie, so it's got the guys with the square jaws and the wide shoulders, and then I'm a captain in this industry, and I'm a confused scientist, and I'm the retired military general, and together we're going to make a rocket to the moon. And it all seemed pretty silly when I saw it as a kid in the 1960s, except it's kind of the Elon Musk story, right?
That's right.
It's not entirely different from that. But the visual effects that George Pal put together were remarkable. The screenplay was written in part by Robert Heinlein, who wrote the original book that this is based on. The moon scenes were painted by Chesley Bonestell, who was the dean of space painters. So, wow, that was incredible. He didn't quite get the lunar surface right. He had a lot of sharp rocks and stuff, but who knew? You know, nobody had been up there at that point. It basically, as private industry gets together, they're kind of talking indirectly about what we all know is the Red Scare. You know, other people are going to get there if we don't. You can hurl bombs at Earth from the moon. We can't let this happen. So the government's not dealing with it. So private industry gets together to save the day. And then at the last second, the government not only doesn't give the money, but they show up with a guy in a car at the launch site of this big magnificent rocket and say, "You can't go anywhere, your rocket's atomic and that's dangerous," which kind of was. So what do they do? Well, gosh, we've only got 17 hours. Oh, hell, let's just get in the rocket and push the big up button and off we go. So that's a little unrealistic. And, you know, there's no ground crew and it's 5 people in the rocket. And of course, one of their crew can't go at the last minute, so they substitute the mechanic with the Brox accent and the wrench in his pocket. And, I mean, it's got all the corny stuff from movies of that era. But since it was one of the first movies of that era, you got to give them a lot of credits. And so they get up to the moon, and they have acceleration couches in the rocket, lots of screaming and faces being pulled back by acceleration, which I looked and looked, and I could. They use compressed air for those scenes where the faces are, mouths are being pulled back and everything. It didn't say how they did it. It might have just been makeup. I couldn't tell. And the rocket, when you see schematics of the rocket, they actually make room for fuel in it. Now, it's water because it's an atomic rocket, but they make room for fuel, which none of these old movies ever did. So that was pretty cool. Now, on the other side of the coin from Destination Moon is Rocketship XM. So Destination Moon started production. It was budgeted at $500,000, which was a fortune for science fiction in that era. another producer heard of this and said, oh, I'm going to beat him to the punch. So he scrambled to make this movie called Rocket Ship XM, which is just a monumental kludge of hideousness. So same kind of thing, similar looking rocket. It actually looks almost identical to Elon Musk's Starship, which is probably the most remarkable thing about it. And same kind of thing, you know, they're going to take off and rockets bound for the moon, upper stage misfires. They did show staging, which is cool. Oh my God, there's a meteor storm. So there's rocks tumbling at the rocket. They go off course. Engines quit. They reignite them. They go out of control. And we missed the moon, but we landed on Mars. Okay, that's a bit of a right turn. So they end up uncovering a couple of tikis in the sand and a lot of radiation. They go, huh, there was an atomic war that wiped out the tiki aliens. And then suddenly this ravishing young woman comes stumbling down a sand dune. And even though she's blind, she starts screaming because the icky alien Earth people are standing there. And then the next thing you know, there's cavemen throwing rocks and spears. It just goes completely off the rails. It's like one of those movies where, if you remember the space movie with the gorilla costume with the space helmet because they couldn't afford any other props, it was almost like that. So some people die. So Lloyd Bridges and the pretty girl, whose name I don't remember, jump on the rocket with one of the injured, and they head back to Earth, but they don't have enough fuel to land. So in a very unusual ending for a movie of this vintage, they turn the rocket around, hit the deceleration engines, and crash and get scattered across Nova Scotia, so that when we go back to the steely-faced military guy who started the whole operation, and the press says, well, I guess it was a failure, and he says, a failure? This wasn't a failure. We're now building Rocket Ship XM2, and that's the end, after you've killed your stars.
No.
The matting was so bad. You know what matting is, blue screen. The yeah. matting on the rocket's takeoff was so bad that the part of it was in shadow, and the physical model, you can actually see the launch pad through it.
Wow.
I've never seen matting that bad before in any movie. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm getting way too hung up on bad movies. So you mentioned Interstellar. We talked about that. Star Trek, the motion picture, I have respect for.
No.
It was too long. No. And when the special edition came out, the director's cut, with an added 17 minutes, I thought, what are you doing? Don't add more footage to it. But you have to respect, first of all, Tarek, while you're grimacing over there, you have to respect they were rebooting a canceled beloved series. This was the first reboot it had gone through. It was going to be a TV movie, and then it was going to be a movie, and then it was going to be a TV series again, and then it was going to be a movie again. So for Robert Wise to pull this off with a script by Alan Dean Foster, who's a respected science fiction writer,
the script
was a little too cerebral for a movie of that kind, and it kind of threw a lot of people off. Can't hold a candle to Star Trek II in terms of cowboy entertainment value, but I give it points for being good science fiction, possibly in the wrong franchise.
Yeah. Do you buy that? There is an episode of the original series where the Enterprise comes across a probe launched from
Nomad.
Earth. Yeah. Yeah. Many, many years ago. That is now like bent on finding its creator and is super mad about it. And that is the essential plot of Star Trek, the motion picture. And it's the one big hang up that I have with that film is that it was at its core a recycled original series plot. But I take your point. You know, it was a reintroduction of the franchise for a film audience at that time.
So, yeah. And Star Trek is all about recycling. And, I mean, they're as green as it gets when you talk about recycling.
And it was the first film to have the big epic coming out of dry dock scene.
Yes.
And only ship in the quadrant film, because that's always the Enterprise is always the only ship in the quadrant that has to go.
Well, they're the very best we've got. And it was the first time we had seen warp stars. Let's see. It was after Star Wars, right? It was a year after Star Wars. It was the first time we had seen different warp stars from Star Wars, but they had rainbow colors. So we liked the rainbow sprinklies because it was kind of like ice cream. I just have to drop in an aside here. I don't remember if it was a book cover or a calendar, but the visual effects producer or supervisor on TNG was a friend. And so before I worked on Deep Space Nine, I helped him do a weekend shoot. And we got to pull the Enterprise 1701A model out of storage, which is the one for the motion picture. And that miniature, and I say miniature, it's 8 feet long. That miniature is stunning. So it's a summer day. I show up to the effects house, which is not on the Paramount lot. We're down some alley on Melrose because we're a non-union joint. And so it's very bright outside. I walk in the stage. It takes a minute for my eyes to adjust because he's got all the lights turned off. But in the center of this enormous soundstage is the 8 foot 1701A model, all hooked up and lit, which he did just because he was a great guy. Name's Gary Hutzel, and he wanted me to have that moment. And I practically fell to my knees and wept. It was so beautiful. And as you walked closer and closer to this model, and mind you, this model cost almost $200,000 in the 70s. As you walk closer to this model, it never breaks the illusion. It looks real to the point that you're 3 inches from it, right. Wow. Down to the kind of polarized painting effects on the hull that pop back and forth as it's leaving dry dock. So enough about that, but it was really a wonderful model. And then years later, they pulled it out for some other movie or show episode and covered it with flat white paint and kind of wrecked the whole thing. Hidden Figures, you know, that's history. So a little less to say about that, but I think it covered a really important topic very well. The Kevin Costner character was apparently an amalgamation of two or three real folks, but it was an important film, and it was something I haven't read the book when I saw the movie, and I knew very little about, at least in terms of the human computers aspect, the race relations aspect. It was something that was news to me, and I thought it was remarkably done.
I really enjoyed it, and I'm it's the same. It was a new bit of history when I, you know, read the book when it had come out, and seeing it on the screen for a public that may have not seen that part of the space program, thought it was a really important story to tell, and I think it really opened up a lot of people's eyes who, you know, really love NASA, but didn't, you know, maybe had glossed over that this whole era in our country, you know, that NASA was not immune to that at the time. So,
and an interesting side note, of all the NASA field centers, so in the early 60s, the order went out from, I think it was LBJ, saying you need to desegregate. And there was a lot of foot dragging and grumbling going on. And as far as I understand, the first field center to do so was Marshall, because Von Braun said, this is the right thing to do. We're going to do it right now. And as we all know, Werner Von Braun didn't have the most savory history in World War II. But surprisingly, when it came to desegregation, he stepped up. And this is in Alabama, which was not an easy place for this to happen. He stepped up and said, this needs to happen right now. So there's an incredible picture of him standing on a podium after having just given a talk, looking down at George Wallace, who in most people's book is one step up from the Antichrist. And Wallace is lecturing him about, you know, basically you've got to keep these people separated. And Von Braun told him, I'm not going to do it. If you don't like it, talk to my boss. His name's the president. So that was the end of that conversation. A great film. And the last one I have on this list is Gravity. Now, a lot of people had issues with Gravity. It had Sandra Bullock in it in spandex, which never hurts. But I thought it was fun. I thought it was visually stunning. There are a couple of really bad physics moments in there, like when she and George Clooney are tethered to the space station and they're flying away from the space station, and the tether pole's taut, and her tether pole's taut and his tether pole's taut, and then he keeps yanking, and it's like, well, wait a minute, he'd bounce back. His motion was arrested. Anybody who took high school physics knows this. But, you know, anti-love or something was pulling on him. So that, I was not fond of seeing the shuttle destroyed. That was a little hard to stomach.
And Hubble.
But overall, Hubble Space Telescope. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, so yeah. Let's do the in memoriam for the spaceship.
Let's march through the destruction, okay? Yeah.
You lose the space shuttle. You lose the Hubble Space Telescope. You lose the International Space Station. You lose the Tiangong Space Station, I believe, as well. Is the China Space Station is in there as well.
So what?
And so you lose them all. Now those this is another movie that I love because
but
of
you
the
didn't
ships.
Lose Sandra Bullock.
No. Yeah, you lost all the other astronauts. So
yeah, but you didn't lose Sandra Bullock.
Poor George Clooney. Poor George. R.I.P. in space.
He deserved to go. He was.
A couple things that caused it to not make one big plus is that the movie's about an hour and a half long, and if you track it, so it starts with this debris storm from an anti-satellite test. Where have we heard that before? By the way, that's actually happening now.
Yeah, so prescient, wasn't it?
And it starts with that first debris field hit, and literally 90 minutes later, the time it takes to actually orbit the Earth, the debris cloud comes back again, which I thought was just magnificent the way that that they had put that together.
And that was terrifying. If you saw it in a theater, that was a terrifying moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And the ships were bang up amazing. They were absolutely spectacular. But, you know, the part that you talk about with the gross inaccuracies about what floating around would be like, it was hard to miss that. Then you've got all of these different spacecraft that are all in the same orbital plane, which we all know they are in fact not. You can't hop skip from one to the other. Right. Although NASA didn't try to do that.
And you can't fly with a fire extinguisher.
Well, right. Wally would disagree, the little robot from Disney. But really it was the inaccuracies there, the fact that Sandra Bullock does not really want to be in space, that she is really new to the crew while she's out on a spacewalk, which I know, it's the space reporter in me. It's hard to swallow that they wouldn't know each other like the back of their hands, being on a crew for a mission. Cause they work so closely together all the time.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the big sticking points. Now she does have the moment where she overcomes everything. She survives. That's great. Spoiler alert. If you haven't seen that movie, sorry to anybody who is listening now, but, the interesting thing that I was really piqued at is I had heard that there was discussion about like a part two or a sequel. Yeah. About what everything people were doing on the ground during that time frame. So the other thing is, what happens now? You've got all this giant debris field in space, and there's no way off the planet anymore because the Kessler syndrome is real, and that's kind of
now.
No one really mentions that in that film, but at least she made
it. So it was a romp, and it ended nicely. So Ant, who's producing the show, should definitely see it because he hasn't seen it yet. All right.
I spoiled it for him.
We would not be responsible if we didn't include First Man on this list. I know you like First Man. I tried really hard to like it. But you know, I've met a lot of the Apollo astronauts. I never met Neil Armstrong in person, but I write about this stuff in books. I have for 15 years, 20 years. So I've studied him to death. I've watched press conferences. I've watched interviews. I've read oral histories. I've, of course, read the long book about him. And listened to the downlink from Apollo 11 probably 80 times, mostly because I had to write something about it. And that wasn't Neil Armstrong. He wasn't that dysfunctional. Now, of course, we don't know his home life, but... What was the actor's name that played him? Why am I suddenly...
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. He was also in Blade Runner 2049. So.
Yeah. He has a particular style of acting, which, you know, I respect his acting. Ryan Gosling. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But I swear to God, and if you talk to people that knew Neil, they said, you know what? He was quiet, but he had a very dry sense of humor. At worst, he was fairly neutral, but he was also a very positive, upbeat person with a quiet but very keen sense of humor. And while the death of his daughter, as portrayed in the film, was very difficult, it didn't put him into a stumbling depression for the next couple of years. And if I'm to believe what I saw in this film, Neil Armstrong spent the entire 2.5 hours of the moonwalk from Apollo 11 wandering around the moon, pining over where to throw his daughter's hospital bracelet. Now, that was manufactured. If you talk to Jim Hansen, who wrote the book, which I have in a panel we were doing, I said, did you put that in? He said, and that wasn't, that was the director's call as an emotional moment. So, you know, movie making, creative license, okay. But it kind of, it felt like it drove the bus a little bit. So that was one complaint. Another was when they're taking off the Gemini flight, which was beautifully shot and the effects were great, all these spacecraft looked like fighters from World War II. There's dirt and grime around the switches. The seats are worn, you know, all this stuff. These things were fresh off the assembly line, untouched, perfect, pristine. So that was a little weird. And there are a few other things. I wasn't keen on the ending, although it was factually accurate. But all that said, it did kind of put you into the moment of the Apollo 11 flight and what led up to it. And it was fun to experience those things on the big screen. What did you think?
Very, very interesting. There is a visceral nature or a visceral feeling to the depiction of spaceflight in that movie that I had not seen before, mm-hmm. not even in The Martian. One of the things, if you've ever watched a SpaceX launch, when they would have the longer webcasts, now it's right. like the one that happened today was like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, they were done. But you can hear in the stream the venting from the rocket, because they have microphones out there at the pad, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and you can hear that creaking and the shaking of everything, and it's absolutely it feels very immersive, even though I'm in my home office in New Jersey at like 5 a.m. watching this, and that movie really, I mean, you're like looking over Neil's shoulder on that Gemini flight, and you're hearing the seat shake, and then the walls are shaking, and everything yeah. is, it was a feeling that I had not seen before, because you kind of mix it with what you're like on an airplane, what it sounds like, but it's everything is shaking and it all sounds crazy, and it's how can they even focus on the dials and the buttons that they got to switch and pull. And so I hadn't seen that kind of a depiction before. And that was the part that really struck me, how rickety a lot of that stuff was, because they had built it all for the first time. And there's that really strange scene. And again, because, I didn't know Neil Armstrong, I did meet him once. He came into the space.com offices and, was introduced to everyone. Like, it wasn't like we got to say hello or anything. But I was in his presence when he was part of, the space.com board, I believe at that time. This is many, many years ago. And he was very quiet then. So I never really got to know, if he was as closed as they depict him in that film, especially after the lunar lander research vehicle crash, which, by the way, as we're recording this, today is the anniversary of that crash where he almost died doing that training exercise. And in the film, he goes home and he's all covered in blood and he's trying to decompress, and he gets immediately asked with questions about what happened, and he just turns around and leaves because he doesn't want to deal with it. I don't know how accurate that might have been, but that must have been super scary just to have that happen when you're getting ready to actually fly to the moon.
Well, and that thing was such a widowmaker. I mean, everybody, they knew it was important, but they despised it. So we agree that that's an important one. I would love to go on about this another hour, but we have to talk about a couple of the worst. So going back into ancient history for me as a young man, it was a year when there weren't a lot of good space science fiction movies playing at the matinee house, because we still wandered down to theaters to watch them when I was young. But a movie called Green Slime came out. And unknown to me, it was a Japanese, American, maybe Italian co-production that was released in Japan as Gamma 3 Big Military Space Operation, with a militaristic score and a lot shorter than the American release, which was called Green Slime. It had a very cheesy rock and roll score. starring Robert Horton and Richard Jekyll, whose names probably don't resonate with you, but they were like two of the most commonly seen bit part, uninteresting, can't act very well TV guys out there. Luciana Paluzzi, who is a ravishing Italian actress that wasn't a bad actress. She just never really got a lot of great roles, but she made the film a little easier to watch for a young adolescent boy. The plot is, after destroying a giant asteroid heading towards Earth, a group of scientists unknowingly bring back a green substance that soon mutates into monsters that feed off electricity. So if you take a small Japanese child, which were the extras they used for the monsters, by the way, put a green garbage bag over them with a bunch of tatters, give them a single red eye and tentacles with car flares burning at the tips, you pretty much got the whole effects roster for the movie, except for the circular space station, which is literally dangling from a visible wire as it spins around. I mean, there isn't a single element of this film that is competent or capable or watchable, except maybe the title burns and the sound recording. We're both okay, if you don't mind sound looping.
So I haven't seen this film, Rod, so I have to take your word for it. But I did watch the trailer, and I was very taken by the fact that they call, first of all, it's called the green slime, but they're not, it's not slime. It's like, I was expecting like the blob, right? Yeah. Like an actual slime, not like these monsters. And then it says that they're a faceless
slime, you see.
Yeah. It says that they're a faceless enemy, but they very clearly have a face. They have an eye. They've got like what looks like a mouth and stuff. And anyway, I had lots of questions. I did like in the trailer the great big flaming space station falling back to Earth. That was pretty cool. I'd like to see how that turns out.
Well, falling because when they light the model on fire, the string that's holding it burns through and falls out of the frame. So, but on the opposite end of that, with a lot more money spent and not much more capably done, Moonfall.
Moonfall.
Now, so I was asked to review it for the magazine.
Very new.
It was very Moonfall kind of the year. Studio. Huh?
Very new. We're flipping from that old vintage to brand new, 2020.
Well, and there's a reason for this, because there's a lot of connective tissue between Moonfall and Green Slime, in my opinion. So you and I both get these invites to the studios, and normally, you know, I write a respectable review, and I can be a little judgmental, but I try to see the good in everything. Basically, what I saw Moonfall that was good was that it was shot in color. And so, you know, the press agent wrote me and said, hey, we didn't get a poster review. And I said, I've never said this to a studio guy before, but you really don't want me to review this. And he said, okay. So I just had to, because it's just all over the place. It's crazy. Now, this is Roland Emmerich, who did Independence Day, which I thought was a great assemblage of old science fiction tropes used brilliantly. Independence Day 2 was not brilliant. But this film was just, I don't even know how to characterize it.
It's bonkers. Just for the plot, for people who maybe haven't seen it, the moon is getting closer to Earth. It's falling out of orbit. No one really knows why. There's a really big twist. I don't know if we want to spoil it, but in order to stop the moon from falling, they have to launch an emergency mission. But of course, there are no space shuttles, because where are they, Rod? Where are the space shuttles?
Oh, they're in museums.
They're in museums.
So we're going to haul one out of a museum, take it Endeavor. Up to Vandenberg, and launch Endeavor. It with a crew of 17 people. And oh my God, the people are running because we're having tidal waves and disasters. So we'll just go. It's a little more complicated than that.
So Ant, our dedicated support, was mentioning Armageddon. And this is... on par. You know, to me, I had a great time watching the movie, but as a space reporter,
really,
I had a very, very because I have a very high suspension of disbelief.
I was checking my watch after 15 minutes.
We turned Armageddon into like a drinking game. Every time they show a clock, right? I challenge you to get through that film with a drinking game, where every time they show a clock, you take a drink, because it is hard. And so it's very similar to that, where if you know what you're going to get, you can have a really, really good time doing it. But at the same time, Again, I mentioned I have a really high suspension of disbelief. We get to a point where they've pulled Endeavor out of mothballs. They've put it on the Vandenberg pad. They've got, like, you know, the actual astronauts that are trained to go on the mission quit because they get scared. That wouldn't happen, right? Those people are the best of the best, right? And so a lot of that stuff just really kind of got me. And I actually was shouting. I couldn't watch it in the theater because of COVID, but we were able to watch it on the home screen. But you're like, no, they're not going to do that. And then, like, 5 minutes later, they're never going to do that. And then they went and they did it. So
at every time. and of all the other ridiculous stuff, shuttle launch, tidal wave, need I say more? I mean, literally, the tsunami is heading for the launch pad. The shuttle just barely makes it, and it clips the engines and the wing, and the shuttle struggles a bit, but it continues to ascend. And it's like, wait, shuttles are delicate things. You can't slap those around with tsunamis and have them launch through the water. I mean, there were just so many things wrong with it. And
I was going to say, it was great to see a space shuttle launch from Vandenberg, because people may not know that, but that was the original plan, was to launch space shuttles on polar missions for the military, etc., from Vandenberg. And you can go and find right now photos of Enterprise in the launch position, like on an MLP there at Vandenberg.
Mobile launch SpaceX platform.
SpaceX owns that pad now. And they launch Falcon rockets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I thought that was an Atlas pad. I guess the last thing I'll say about it is the image of the moon skimming the mountains coming towards them while they're in Los Angeles or wherever they are, and buses and trucks and buildings being sucked up by the lunar gravity because it's interfering with Earth's gravity, but the people are just standing there watching it. And it's all a bit like the other Roland Emmerich movies, where the station wagon full of the family with the barking dog and the screaming children is driving just ahead of the fissure that's opening in the ground. Rear wheels are spinning over the edge. I mean, it was just every moment of this film. And this doesn't even count.
Is that 2012 that you're talking about right there?
Yeah.
Is that 2012?
Yeah. This doesn't even count getting the moon, discovering it's hollow and that it's filled with angry nano things. So
spoiler alert.
I did finally write a capsule review on Facebook that basically said angry nano bees invade the moon while self-pitying astronauts pout on Earth and do nothing about it. Okay, so not a big fan of Moonfall. we already talked about Rocketship XM. We did get an email from a listener, Doug Ferguson, who suggested for the thumbs down list, Space Camp. Now, I know you're probably going to say, I liked Space Camp because you were young when it came out. But if you watch it now, Tarek, dopey, horrible film.
Oh, well, so Space Camp, I Doug Ferguson, thank you for the suggestion. I disagree. and for two reasons. Number one, Space Camp was the one of the first movies I chose to go see on my own. And I did have to take my sister along for the Space Camp My Little Pony double feature, so that if I wanted to see the movie again, I had to babysit my sister.
Okay, you're embarrassing both of us now. That's enough.
But that film has a lot of feelings, I think, like what Star Wars would have for people too, because that was one of the codifications of my passion for space, and to see kids doing it, you know, with you've got a robot with Jinx, Leia Thompson.
Okay, but wait a minute. So I went to space camp. You went to space camp. You used, at least when I went in the 80s, you were using worn out, basically mothballed Gemini training hardware, which was pretty cool in itself if you knew what it was. But you weren't going in a real space shuttle and sitting in there and, oops, somebody pushed the wrong button and now we're taking off by accident. Oh, well, push the release, blow the explosive bolts holding the shuttle down. See you, kids. Right. Good luck.
The whole reason they launch into space is because the SRB has ignited on one side. And if they don't launch the other one, then they will flip over and crash. And of course, they're solid propellants, so you can't have one burn faster than the other. To get off the ground. So, but they made it. They made it, right? Tate Donovan, everyone,
survived. I mean, if I'm fine that they made it for the sake of the movie. By that point, by the time the accidental liftoff had occurred, I was done.
Space Camp is a movie that I would pay to see remade for the 21st century. I would go see that movie.
Why?
I want to see.
It's a stupid idea.
Is it though, Rod? Is it?
Yes.
Right.
No, it really is. There, you know, you could have a clever argument in there somewhere, but it was really a horrible, awful film. It was up there with, what was that Roger Corman? Battle Beyond the Stars, the Roger Corman movie. Yes. His biggest budget to date, $500,000 in 1980, ripping off Star Wars with a spaceship that looked like fallopian tubes. That's all that could come to my mind when I'm seeing this weird spaceship. Had Sybil Danning, John Saxon, Richard Thomas, and Sam Jaffe, to his everlasting shame for the rest of his very short life. Supposed to be the Magnificent Seven in space, but it did have visual effects by Jim Cameron, music's by Jamie Horner of Star Trek fame, and John Sayles wrote the screenplay. So true to Corman ethos, he got really good people to work on this really hideous movie that he directed. The budget was $2 million.
Battle Beyond the Stars is a movie that I always get excited about when I come across it on TV because of the opening credit sequence, and then you see the title, and then you're like, oh, it's Battle Beyond the Stars. I'm going to go switch to a different thing now. So it's like I always forget how it starts. So.
This has been a lovely stroll, and I would love to continue, but I just, as our final mention for things that didn't fit into the categories, Galaxy Quest is a brilliant, brilliant film that is obviously a Star Trek parody, but it's not. They never mention Trek. They never mention any characters from it. It's just very clearly that. But it is so brilliantly captured, and Alan Rickman, RIP, does such a great job. He says, by Grapthar's hammer, I will avenge thee. Every moment in that film is brilliant. I assume you enjoyed it.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. As my colleague Chelsea Goad puts it, it is the best Star Trek movie, Galaxy Quest. So
yeah.
That's exactly how she wrote it. So,
and good visual effects. First Man on the Moon, another George Powell production, great animation, great stop motion. Great visual effects for its time. Kind of silly by today's standards, but if you like vintage Edwardian journeys to the moon, it's worth checking out. And it's got great, great space aliens and some fairly deep thinking moments. Star Trek First Contact.
Yes. Yeah. Best Star Trek
great.
Movie. That's not Star Trek 6.
I think it was the only feature film of Trek that Jonathan Frakes directed. He then did Thunderbirds, which, as he put it, I spent a night drinking with him a few years back, and he said, Thunderbirds, the live action version of Thunderbirds, put me in director's jail. So he's still waiting to emerge. He's directing tons of TV, though, and Star Trek still. But I thought that was extraordinary. And you got any last...
I would say, and I know that you disagree, but I would say that Eddie Murphy's The Adventures of Pluto Nash
still I was hoping we'd get through with
a
that.
a guilty pleasure. It is Eddie Murphy as a reformed criminal just out of jail, starting his own bar on the moon. While he's been incarcerated, there's been a whole seismic shift of who's running the moon. There's a new mob boss. Spoiler alert, it's Eddie Murphy's clone. Oh my God! Right? It is amazing.
Because we need to.
It is so much fun. It is so worth watching. And it was shelved after it was made. Everyone should watch it. You and my wife are tired of hearing about me talk about
this. I watched as much of it as I could, but there's a reason that Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 4. I don't think they've ever rated anything lower than a 10 except for that movie. 4 fingers. You see them? They gave it a 4.
Stand by it. I stand by it. The Adventures of Pluto Nash. Everyone check it out.
It was one of the biggest disasters. And on their $80 million budget, do you know what the worldwide gross was on that film?
No. I assume it was a trillion because it's so amazing, right?
1/10 of the production budget. It was a astonishing disaster. Well, thank you for joining me with your erroneous opinions, Tarek, about these films. And no, I'm just kidding. I agree with you on 90%, you know, 70% of it. And where can we learn more about all the groovy things you do?
Well, the big things that we're watching right now at space.com is all of the new Star Treks and everything. So you can find out all the great things about that at space.com. And I'll be talking about them and this crazy Star Trek Strange New Worlds box I got this week on Twitter at Tarek J. Malik.
You got like a studio promo kit?
Yeah, yeah. Tie-dye shirt. And
how come you always get all? I mean, look, you got that chair, and you got the zero G flight, which I haven't mentioned for at least a couple of hours, and you get all these cool packages, and I get like emails saying, "Oh, yeah, maybe we'll get back to you." All right, well, that's the way it goes. And of course, speaking of me, you can find the magazine I edit for the National Space Society at adastramagazine.com, and my website is at pilebooks.com. Thanks for joining us again. And staying with us for this very long, but hopefully somewhat enlightening episode about the best and worst space movies. Feel free to email us to agree, disagree, or just tell us how wonderful we are at twis@twit.tv. New episodes publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe and do tell your friends and review us. And you can head to our website at twit.tv/twis. You can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and Twit TV on Instagram. See you next time.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed, with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.